On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Culture commentator Sherry Parks on reactions to the mass shooting in Orlando. Was the shooter a self-radicalized terrorist, a deranged abuser, a virulent bigot, a self-loathing gay man, or some combination thereof? As the dead are remembered and buried, what will we remember months and years from now about how this tragedy changed the conversation about the fight against terrorism, access to firearms, and bigotry against the LGBTQ community, Latinos, and Muslims? Sherry Parks is an associate dean at the University of Maryland College Park. She'll help us unpack lessons from the massacre at Pulse. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Godspell at Cockpit in Court. Nathan Sterner has the local news Maryland Morning. It's underway right after these headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Hope you had a great weekend. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Glad you are with us. The massacre in Orlando last week touched on so many different pressure points, from so-called self-radicalized lone wolf terrorists to bigotry against the LGBTQ, Latino, and Muslim communities. As there was after the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, and elsewhere, there have been renewed calls for tighter restrictions on gun sales. A nearly 15-hour filibuster led by Democratic Senator Chris Murphy resulted in a deal for the Senate to cast votes on the so-called no-fly, no-buy legislation, as well as measures to increase background checks on people buying firearms on the internet and at gun shows. All of this took place amid the backdrop of a presidential race in which the standard bearers for each major party demonstrated vastly different approaches to shaping the conversation about how to move forward from this horrific tragedy. So this morning we check in once again with Dr. Sherry Parks for some help unpacking all of this. She's an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she is also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. Morning, Sherry. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good to see you.
So there are so many dimensions to this tragedy in Orlando, and so many people. You're an expert on seeing how people form narratives when things like this happen. And there's a narrative from the terrorist perspective. There's a narrative from the LGBTQ perspective. There's a narrative from firearms and access to firearms perspective. There's a domestic abuse narrative. There are narratives that come at this from a million different points. I mean, how does it strike you that people have started to understand this and appreciate this now, you know, 8 days after it happened?
Well, I think the mainstream media are just now beginning to put their hands around the complexity. At first, they were trying to tell one story or the other and kind of tumbling over themselves. It's interesting because social media has played such a role here, both with the shooter himself, and I mean, they're releasing some of the social media that he tweeted as he was in the building, but also the different communities have been very, very active. And so there have been there's the main narrative. I mean, television and radio are still the main stage, but then social media has certainly been pushing them. And we've been hearing much more of the personal stories, both of the people who were shot, their families. The funerals have started, and we've seen those, and of the shooter's families, actually. So that there's this buzz that can only happen with social media because you can only put so many stories in so many minutes or in so many pages. And so there's this national conversation. I've said before that it's times like this when we really act as a nation. All of our national events and rituals are mediated, and so we're beginning to see that. And I think, in a way, it shows how we're changing as a country, that all these conversations, in a way, have to happen at once because you can't silence one or the other. We know that, for instance, in the Black Civil Rights Movement, the voices of women were silenced to some degree. We know that, for instance, Dorothy Height came to the march on Washington with a speech and was told that she couldn't speak.
Yeah, wasn't allowed to give it, yeah.
And we know that gay and lesbians were silenced. And so that can't happen now because there's this other avenue where those voices can come out and be heard, and then that pushes the mainstream.
And it has become a ritual, hasn't it? I mean, President Obama, when you hear him speak, it's kind of, you can see the frustration and resignation in his eyes and hear it in his voice that, boy, he's been through this drill before. And nothing seems, the needle just doesn't seem to move.
And I think the point of ritual is really important here. It's not routine. I mean, someone said this is becoming routine, and that's not true. It's still traumatic and dramatic, and we still mourn. But there have been enough. I think there have been 12 in his presidency where he's come out and had to make the speech and usually visited the site, that it has become a ritual. And it's really important when you talk about a culture, a nation, that these rituals are important. And I think what's really different this time is who gets to be in the ritual. So the ritual is, I mean, we hear about it, we go to our TVs and our radios and social media, and we learn about it, we mourn, first there's shock, you know, we go through those stages of grief, and we mourn, and then we find out more about the people, and we feel, I've seen memorials in Maryland for them, remembering Orlando, where people have put down flowers.
There's a big meeting at the Why Not lot on Charles and North Avenue day after it happened. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people came to show solidarity, and I think that was repeated in communities across
the
country.
And so you have that. And who gets involved in the ritual is family. And so here you have this now much more inclusive set of rituals, because you have sexual and gender minorities, and you have racial and ethnic minorities being pulled in. Now, of course, this comes at the expense of another group, because there's this conversation that is being fueled by the presidential election about Muslims and Arabs and profiling Muslims and Arabs. No, it does not matter that is a proper identification of the person who was doing the shooting, but it this conversation enlarges. And so generally what happens is that you have one group, I'm not saying this is a good thing, I'm just describing it, gets pushed out and other groups get pulled in. In 9/11, there was this very strange term of Native minorities. And at first, when I heard it, I didn't realize they meant me.
Native minorities.
Native minorities, because I thought
Black folks who live in the United States.
Right. Yeah. Well, one quote was the minorities we know. And so there was this confusion. But African Americans were pulled in toward the center in the national imagination, and so that they could push out other minorities and still not seem racist. So, you know, blackness gets used in that way a lot. And here what's happening is that LGBTQ folks and Latinos are being pulled in, and supposed Muslims, supposed Arabs are being pushed out.
Is this then an opportunity? Well, obviously it's an opportunity, but is this in fact a moment that is going to bring us together, or is it going to just sharpen and make more acute the divides between the people who are, you know, pro, quote unquote, gun control versus, you know, anti-gun control, or people who are, you know, who resonate with the message of Mr. Trump about building a wall, profiling, keeping Muslims out as a generic matter rather than individual terrorists. I mean, the divides in the presidential race. I don't know. Is this gonna overstep those? Or is this gonna conquer those? I mean, the fact that everybody had this shared mourning and this shared grief.
Well, it's interesting because both things are happening at once. I mean, we just heard a story on NPR about Touré organizing black gun owners. And the NRA actually does not represent the majority of people who own guns in the United States. Most of them are more moderate than the NRA is. I mean, there's statistics that show that pretty clearly. And so the idea, the image of the gun owner as this white male who is angry is beginning to get unraveled. At the same time, because of the presidential election, that very angry, racially charged, racist line of thinking has come out in the open. So this is not a polite conversation anymore because of the presidential election. And that vein of it's scapegoating racism, actually. I am unhappy. I've been left behind by the society, and it must be those people's fault. That very ugly strain has surfaced. It was always there, but now we know it's there.
Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. She stops by regularly to comment on what's happening in our culture. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. It's interesting how the data points keep getting stacked up when these things happen. When it comes to, for example, the anti-Muslim rhetoric of the presidential campaign, that's in the context of places like Baltimore County, which are now is now considering recognizing two Muslim holidays in the school calendar next year. You've got the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times reporting that 51 State Department diplomats are now urging the president to be more aggressive militarily in Syria. And it's just kind of interesting how that memo, that cable gets leaked or publicized right at the time mm-hmm. when we've got yet another potentially terrorist act. And again, you know, Attorney General Lynch is releasing today transcripts of the calls between the shooter and law enforcement during the siege at Pulse. So we'll find out a little bit more about, in fact, what his terrorist leanings may or may not have been. But these data points keep getting stacked up, and the coincidence of the proximity to each of these occurrences is kind of fascinating.
Well, and as you suggested, some of them are forced. I mean, the idea around Syria was leaked. That was not something that the population called for. I mean, and anytime you go to war in the United States, this will seem like a side trip, I hope not. You have to build up public opinion. And you see that before every war, you have to build up public opinion. You can't go to war without the support of the American people. And so you mentioned narrative. There has to be a narrative. And I don't know if Americans have been paying that close attention to what's been happening in Syria, except for the refugees status. But that then enters this complex set of narratives that you've been talking about.
And you got to wonder, for example, the movement to recognize the two Muslim holidays in the Baltimore County school calendar has been going on for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder whether or not this event will tip the scale one way or the other.
Well, you know, and there's always the backlash story, because there are stories now. I just saw one on 60 Minutes last night of inclusivity. There was somebody, a man who hated Muslims, and now he actually shot into the mosque. And they forgave him, and now they're best friends. And so there's this counter-narrative that I think is very strong.
Yeah, interesting. All right, lots more to talk about, and we will do so after a break for the news. Sherry Parks is an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship, and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities, the University of Maryland College Park, where she's also an Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies. Her latest book is called Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. Lots more with Sherry Parks after a break for the news. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
The terrorist in Orlando was not born in Afghanistan, as Trump claims. A ban on Muslims would not have stopped this attack. Neither would a wall. I don't know how one builds a wall to keep the internet out. So not one of Donald Trump's reckless ideas would have saved a single life in Orlando.
The bottom line is that the only reason the killer was in America in the first place was because we allowed his family to come here. When I'm elected, I will suspend immigration from areas of the world where there is a proven history of terrorism against the United States.
And I hate to say it again, but it's going to happen again and again and again, because we're not doing what we have to be doing.
Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton speaking last week in the wake of the mass shooting at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the reactions and responses to the terrible tragedy in Orlando with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland College Park. She serves as an associate dean there and an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. So, Sherry, two vastly different examples of tone. People have talked about temperament in this election and about Mr. Trump's, lack of a proper temperament to be commander in chief. I wonder, when you hear those kinds of remarks, and then Trump sort of doubled down on racial profiling over the weekend, saying that it's common sense, we've got to simply start doing this, particularly in the Muslim community. What's your reaction to that? How is this fitting into this broader narrative of how we're thinking about stuff in Orlando?
Well, tone definitely matters, and what we want from our presidents is that they are, I mean, this will seem circular, presidential, but I mean, leader-like. The question that people are using, do you want someone who uses that tone that Donald Trump uses to have nuclear capability? So that idea of how does anger transfer? Gender plays a role clearly here, because people who have done kind of gender stereotype analysis would suggest that the president is papa and Congress is mama, the person who takes care of us. So Hillary has to jump over that, obviously, and show that she can be presidential. And so she wears her pantsuits, and she speaks in a way that is very, very, even when she's angry, very moderate, very toned. And he gets to be kind of not the angry woman, but he gets to be the angry man, and he threatens people, and he said, I will win the presidency alone if I don't have the support of Republicans, which I think seems to be heroic, but is more angry than not. And so I think the tone of the narrative is very important. And there's another complexity here, is that this isn't being fought the way most presidential elections are being fought. And tone is really important here.
Let's listen to a little bit from Chad Griffin. He's with the Human Rights Campaign. This is comments he made about Mr. Trump tweeting right after the news from Orlando broke about how much he appreciated people giving him a pat on the back for predicting all of this. This is Chad Griffin.
I bet there is not a single family member or friend or brother or sister or girlfriend or boyfriend that is suffering from this great loss that found any comfort in what Donald Trump had to say today. Instead, he was up there bragging about the fact that he claims he predicted this.
The role of comforter in chief. I mean, President Obama, very good at it. Ronald Reagan considered very good at it. To a certain extent, Mr. Clinton, when he was president, considered very good at it. Are people having a tough time thinking about Trump as comforter in chief?
Well, several people have commented in the media that he has trouble not talking about himself. He has this ability to draw the attention back to him, even when there's a massacre. And he did that. And nobody is comforted by "I told you so," even if this will continue to happen. And we know this because we don't really, our borders are porous, which is an important part of being American, and part of the cost, unfortunately, is that that means that people can get in if they want to. Of course, they didn't have anything to do with this event, had nothing to do with this event. It's interesting, because Donald Trump is not stupid. And so he says, well, it was because we kept his family out, which sounds a little less preposterous than we kept his parents out. I mean, we don't know if we're talking about we let his cousin in and then he came in too, if we just stick to the family part. And so I think that idea that the president is supposed to be magnanimous, is supposed to be for the people, is the counter-narrative to Donald Trump. And I think one of the reasons why his poll numbers are going down is that people are having trouble imagining him in this presidential role. He's supposed to have pivoted by now.
Yeah, well, the pivoting, people are still holding their breath waiting for that, that's for sure. The intersection of the LGBTQ community and politicians has been very interesting, because there are all sorts of politicians who appeared to sort of embrace the LGBTQ community after this tragedy, who before last Sunday were certainly very vocal about doing things to suppress rights of people in that community. A few folks have been called out on it. Anderson Cooper had a somewhat celebrated argument with the Attorney General of Florida, who had, worked to get rid of marriage equality, and then was trying to position herself as a person who is very sympathetic to the cause of gay and lesbian people.
Well, and that's the pull of the mourning narrative, of the death narrative, that, and I kept thinking, is the enemy of my enemy my friend? Because people who had actively worked against gay rights and same-sex marriage and other types of anti-discrimination measures are suddenly, they have no choice. They could say, oh, well, you know, remember after, I mean, during the AIDS crisis, there were people who said, well, this is because, you know, we have been too lenient with gay people. That narrative won't fly now. And in the face of a massacre, it would have just seemed crazy.
Yeah. This is Spencer Cox. He's the Attorney General of Utah, conservative Republican, who made an extraordinary speech at one of these local gatherings to show solidarity with people in Orlando. So this was a day or two after the event at Pulse Nightclub. And he essentially apologized for having been politically, essentially anti-gay.
I'm here because yesterday morning, 49 Americans were brutally murdered. And it made me sad. And it made me angry. And it made me confused. I'm here because those 49 people were gay. I'm here because it shouldn't matter, but I'm here because it does. Now, I'm not here to tell you that I know exactly what you are going through. I'm not here to tell you that I feel your pain. I don't pretend to know the depths of what you are feeling right now. But I do know what it feels like to be scared. And I do know what it feels like to be sad. And I do know what it feels like to be rejected. And more importantly, I know what it feels like to be loved.
It's an extraordinary speech from a guy who, has been very much part of the, family values wing of the Republican Party. But you could hear the emotion in his voice. You can hear how moved he was. And he was warmly embraced by the LGBTQ community in Utah at that event. It's really quite extraordinary.
He was actually physically embraced. I mean, people came up on the stage and hugged him. So let's unpack it a bit, if we may. The first thing he said is that there were 49 Americans. He didn't. There's no modifier. They weren't gay. They weren't. They were Americans first, and that is inclusivity.
Yeah. So he didn't dig down gay, Latino.
Right. They are Americans, and he lets that say. And then he said, it made me sad. It made me angry. So that's going back to that idea of the mourning narrative, is that 49 Americans died. That's the most important part. And I had the feelings I'm supposed to have. Emotions are actually socialized. We know what we're supposed to feel when that happens. If you've ever seen a 2-year-old at a funeral, you know what it looks like when somebody's not properly socialized yet. And then, the parents will work to get him or her to at least sit still and not, sing out loud a happy song. So we know how we're supposed to feel if we are properly socialized adults. And that's what he did. And then he did something I think, as you said, is very extraordinary. He said, I don't pretend to know what you feel, but I think you have the same emotions as I do. I know what it feels like to be sad. I know what it feels like to be scared. And he essentially said, love is love. And I know it. And so your emotions are pretty much like mine. And I think, that is the biggest kind of, that people are people, and love is love, and people go through their lives, and they all want the same thing to some degree. He goes on, when he talks about being scared, a part of the narrative that we haven't talked about is that the importance of the club as a safe space. And there have been lots of folks who've said, this is not just people dancing. This is the only place I can come to where I feel safe, where people just love me for me. And he's acknowledging that you have the same feelings as I do. You should have the same safety that I, as a white, straight male, do, and you don't.
And this club, founded by a guy who's now here in Baltimore, he's running the Hippodrome Theater. A guy named Ron Legler was in Orlando for many years before he came up here to Baltimore. And he and the sister of a friend of his who had died of AIDS founded this nightclub. But as you say, it's a gathering place. They do job training. They have resources for people, healthcare resources. They have it's more than just a place to go and dance.
Well, I mean, Orlando has provoked lots of private conversations where people, didn't think about the fact that their gay or lesbian or transgender friend was scared all the time, and that they needed a safe space like a club. And there have been lots of, I know, private family conversations where parents have turned to their child and said, is that what it's like? And the parents said, you know, the kids said, yeah, that's what it's like.
And of course, there are some heartbreaking stories about young people who were outed by their death.
Right.
They had not had an opportunity to be out to their families, and the families sort of found out about it because they died in this particular circumstance.
And the family hears that in one fell swoop that your child is dead and that they're gay. And so you suddenly are mourning a person who's different than the person in your mind than the person you thought you knew. And that's a lot to take in. But I think something that almost any parent can associate themselves with, of how much of your child's life do you actually know?
Let's talk about the political potential here. Gun control leapt, as it often does, leapt right to the headlines after this. So there were, you know, there was the terrorist narrative, and then how did the terrorists get the gun narrative. There was a bill right here in the Maryland General Assembly just this past session about keeping people on the terrorist watch list unable to purchase firearms. Luke Clippinger sponsored that legislation. It did not pass, but now Mike Bush is talking about its increased chances of being approved in the next session. Is the LGBTQ community primed to get behind gun control efforts? In other words, this LGBTQ community that's proven itself to be a good, organized political force.
Oh, yeah.
Would they, you know, allocate their very substantial resources and political muscle to an issue like gun registration and gun regulation?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know that they have acted in two ways that are really, really strong. There is the overt way to do it, which might be a bit of a pivot. I mean, you're working alongside people who have worked against you. That I don't know how that. But also, I mean, they're very, very good at working silently and strongly with a lot of money and a lot of organization. So it might be it'll be interesting to watch to see how that plays out. Domestic violence, which you mentioned early on, plays a role here too, because I mean, I think everybody understands the terrorist watch list. I think many people have not. Heretofore understood the connection between domestic violence, which is underreported, undertreated, and just hasn't been paid as much attention to, and terrorism. So now domestic violence has been elevated to this level of national concern.
Right, because the shooter's first wife certainly has talked about how she was subjected to all sorts of physical abuse until she was able to get out of that relationship.
And there's a link between domestic violence and public violence.
And this is not one of those guys who people said, oh, gee, he was so quiet and, you know, friendly, and I never in a million years would have thought that he would do something like this. This is a gentleman who people had noticed his violent proclivities for some time. He was on actually a watch list by the FBI. They couldn't really do much, given that he hadn't committed any crimes. He hadn't done anything. And of course, FBI under now increased scrutiny about how they're handling these cases that they're following. But it's fascinating to see how in this case a lot of people are saying, yeah, this makes sense. This guy was a powder keg, and we saw this coming.
Well, and of course, the balance is our civil liberties, as opposed to making sure that anybody who might do a crime, track them and know about them, because we all know people who have slipped into those spaces in between, some and innocently. And so it's very, very difficult, because the law is often not, as the way it's practiced, a nuanced set of practices.
Yeah, it's also interesting, the social media stuff. And as we finish up here, just got a couple seconds. Here he is searching Facebook and Twitter to make sure people were talking about him while he was inside the nightclub. I mean, it's amazing the role that social media continues to play, and it continues to elevate its importance in these events each time they happen.
It means I matter.
Yeah. Well, Sherry Parks, always good to see you. Thank you so much. We shall have you back soon and continue these kinds of conversations. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean in the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she teaches in the Department of American Studies. She's also the author of Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. Sherry Parks also leads the University of Maryland Arts and Humanities Center for Synergy. They're producing an ongoing series called Baltimore Stories, Narratives, and the Life of an American City. The next event in that series is Thursday night at Wombwork Productions on Walbrook Avenue in Baltimore. It's a rollout of a new form of public media being developed called Art of Transformation. And then on Saturday afternoon at the UB Blake Center in Baltimore, there will be a panel discussion about the new roles of music in protest movement narratives. We've got a link to more information at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. So before we take a break for the news, this item from our mailbag. We heard from Anikwenzi Ogbue, who lives in the original Northwood neighborhood of Baltimore. He wrote after our conversation with Patrick McCarthy and Tommy Hires of Baltimore's Promise. That's a consortium of business, government, education, and philanthropic leaders who focus on the problems facing children. He writes, "Thank you for discussing the unexpected result that additional funds can have if provided directly to low-income parents to benefit their families. Similarly, providing direct funds to businesses and entrepreneurs in low-income communities is a proven program in Nigeria. It was studied by the World Bank, and it's being replicated in other developing countries to provide entrepreneurs with access to capital. This should be implemented in Baltimore, because many low- to middle-income Black-owned businesses and social development programs are successful despite running on shoestring budgets." Mr. Ogbue, we appreciate your taking the time to write. If you'd like to share your reactions and comments to what you've heard here on Maryland Morning, you can drop us a line at mdmorning@wipr.org. You can also reach us at our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, or you can send us a tweet at Maryland Morning or at Tom Hall, WIPR. Coming up after a break for the news, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me with her weekly theater review this morning. We'll talk about a new production of Godspell at Cockpit in Court. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wipr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Monday morning. That means it's time for our weekly theater review with Maryland Morning's intrepid theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. Hey, Judy, how you doing?
Fine, Tom.
So you have been to see Godspell, an icon of the musical theater, if ever there were one. It's at the Cockpit in Court. They're in residence on the Essex campus of Community College of Baltimore County. Godspell dates back to 1971. Actually, it was pretty daring at the time. I know this show. This is one of the few examples in which we'll talk about a show that I actually am familiar with, because when I was a kid in high school in 1971, I played this show many, many times. It was daring, I guess, because there were hippies portraying Jesus and his followers. It doesn't seem like it would be particularly daring today. But what about Cockpit's production? Does it have that 60s, 70s feel, or did they try something new? Did they try to update it?
Well, Tom, James Honeycutt, who directed and choreographed this production, does a little bit of both. It's kind of a mix of that hippie, anti-establishment sensibility. It opened in the same year in New York as Jesus Christ Superstar. There was kind of a, this was in the air then.
Yeah, there was a glut of Jesus musicals.
Yeah, that's right. And when it opened, it had a lot of up-to-the-minute references, and this one does too. But, of course, the minute is more recent now. So it has some references. Some of these newer references come from a revival that was done on Broadway in 2011. Believe it or not, Donald Trump was actually mentioned in that 2011 revival. And he is mentioned here, but in addition to saying, "You're fired," There's a line this time about a wall.
It reminds me of like the Gilbert and Sullivan shows that they throw in, you know, topical jokes. I mean, is Godspell one that they always throw in topical jokes?
I don't know if they always do. This show certainly can stand it and allows for it. And because it was done in 2011, I think there's a certain freedom in there. And it always was a show that was of its time. So I guess that fits. We should say that this is a musical adaptation of the Gospel of Matthew, and it was created by John Michael Tebelek and Stephen Schwartz. Jesus and his followers in this version have cell phones talking about updating. There are references to Twitter. There are references to Facebook. At one point, the character of a judge is wheeled on in a big revolving chair like the judges in The Voice, and the words, "I want you," were painted on the base of the chair's platform. So the production has a little fun with the material, and that is, yes, I think, in keeping with the original.
It's like the ninth beatitude that people don't often remember. Blessed are those who tweet, for they shall be found to be kind of stupid a lot of the times. Yeah. So this show, Godspell, has a relatively rare distinction in that many of its songs actually passed over to the pop charts. I know when I was playing it in the 70s, these were songs that you heard on the radio. It wasn't that you just heard them in the theater. How do they strike you now? I mean, it's easy for songs like this, some 40-odd years later, to sound kind of dated. What do you think? Are they fresh?
They're definitely familiar, more familiar than fresh, I think. Stephen Schwartz composed this score very quickly, and he was able to do that in part because a number of the songs are actually an instance of him setting existing hymns to new music, Turn Back, O Man, and All Good Gifts. So those songs are really familiar on two levels. But they get very high-spirited, energetic performances at Cockpit. They have a very good band. And they make the most of the best-known song. Now, you can tell me what that is, I'm sure.
Indeed.
Yes. They turn it into an audience sing-along. The house lights come up and the cast goes into the aisles. The lyrics are projected on a screen in multiple languages. This is a very inclusive show. So let's listen to Cockpit doing that best-known song.
Ah, yes. Day by Day. It sounds like a very earnest attempt at that tune. A very famous song and a good song. This, you mentioned that Godspell was Stephen Schwartz's first show. He went on to write Pippin and Wicked. I mean, he has made himself quite a career on Broadway. But does this sound like a youthful work? I mean, can you sort of tell early Schwartz versus, you know, late Schwartz with Wicked and the great songs that are in that show?
Well, he was only 23 years old when he wrote this, 3 decades before Wicked. The show includes a brief reference to Wicked, by the way. I think it does seem like a youthful work, but it's also a show that is about youth, so that's actually an asset. And this young cast at Cockpit plays it like a group of overexcited kids. Sometimes they're a little too overexcited and some of the lyrics get obscured. Ryan Slattery, who plays Jesus, plays him as a kind of preppy, likable guy. And Jake Zarenko is double cast as John the Baptist and Judas. It's always done that way. He plays both characters.
He's a good guy and a bad guy.
The flip side. He plays both of them with a little bit of arrogance, though, and he doesn't do anything to distinguish between them, which I think is a little confusing. I should say, in terms of the youth of the show, the youth of the score, Godspell is a show that Stephen Schwartz has stayed involved with over the years. So it was made into a movie 2 years after the New York show, the off-Broadway show, opened. And he wrote a new song called Beautiful City that replaced We Beseech Thee in the movie. Both of those songs were included in the 2011 Broadway revival, and both of them are included in this production. Beautiful City is a solo for Jesus, and Ryan Slattery does a lovely job. He sings it with just keyboard accompaniment, and you see projections of bombed-out cities and then young people and construction workers working to rebuild them. So it does have a definite topicality.
All right, let's give a listen to that.
We can build a beautiful city, not a city of angels, can build a city of men.
That kid's got a good voice. He sings nicely. Yes. Ryan Slattery. So he plays Jesus in this production, Cockpit in the Courts production of Godspell. So this is the beginning of the summer season for Cockpit and Court. They only do shows during the summer, and this is their first one. Are they getting off to a good start with this production of Godspell?
They are. I think they are. Cockpit and Court took a production of Godspell to the Soviet Union back in 1991 as part of a theater exchange. So Cockpit itself has some history with this show. And in this current production, James Honeycutt has staged an especially strong ending. It's not an earth-shattering revival, but I would give it a small hallelujah.
A small hallelujah for Godspell. You know, this seems to me, Judy, to be the kind of show that works really well for a community-based theater like Cockpit. I mean, this is the cast is not teeny, but it's not huge either, so it's got a reasonable number of people.
And the band is relatively small.
Right?
It's basically kind of rock band.
It's a pop band, so it's not like you need a big orchestra. The songs are doable by high school kids, you know, young actors, aspiring people, young professionals. So it seems like this is a good choice. All right, terrific, Judy. Well, thank you so much. And next week you're going to tell us about The Three Musketeers, which is being presented outside by the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. They do their summer series in this beautiful thing in Ellicott City.
The Patapsco Female Institute.
Right. Yes. And I was there for the first time last week and saw their production, Romeo and Juliet, which I thought was terrific. And it was really fun being outside.
Oh, it's a gorgeous setting, too.
Yeah. So it'll be fun to talk about that next week. Thanks so much. We'll see you then.
Thank you, Tom.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Cockpit in Court's production of Godspell continues through Sunday. Again, that's on the Essex campus of the Community College of Baltimore County, Godspell. And we'll have a link to all of the information about tickets and times, etc., on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It is Maryland Morning on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. For Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, we appreciate your tuning in. We'll see you on Wednesday. Have a great day.